is it? So what I'm going to try to do, sorry, I'm going to say is really that I have to finish in 1 hour, but please do ask questions, because I think a lot of this is within a certain approach to quantum theory, which is maybe not familiar to people, although it is really Raphael Sorkin's. A lot of these are Raphael Sorkin's ideas, based on his ideas. So today I'm going to tell you something about how to construct a quantum dynamics for quantum sets. And some of this work, earlier work was done with Joe Henson and Graham Brightwell, and more recent work is with Fade Auker and Stephen Johnson. And what I'm going to do is begin with a very brief review of quasi sets, what exactly we mean when we talk about quasi sets. Then I'll describe this model, which is sort of a rough and ready model for 2D quantum gravity. And some surprising results have come out of it. This leads us, however, to the question of what one means when one is trying to construct a quantum theory of gravity. What are the kinds of observables that one would like to be able to construct? Can you construct covariant observables in the theory? And one way of addressing such questions is within the quantum measure formulation, which Raphael started working on in the early 90s, and has sort of come to fruition in the last couple of years. And as an illustration of how to employ this formulation, in a particular population dynamics for quasi sets, but a complex population dynamics. And in my abstract, I said something about one being more intrinsic than the other. The first model that we constructed using this for the 2D gravity was one in which you borrow a lot of structure from the continuum. So you're sort of borrowing things from the continuum and saying that somehow this fundamental object should obey dynamics that's dictated by the continuum. And that's all very well, but ultimately one would like to be able to construct a dynamics which is more intrinsic, which is based on some more fundamental principles, something that's more natural to a quasi set. And the second class of dynamics comes under that, that class. And then there are some open questions when you start to implement this quantum measure formulation on these models. Then, in order to construct covariant observables, you sort of have to require something of your quantum measure, and we find that these things don't actually satisfy these requirements. And the question is, do you abandon what you have, or do you look for different paths which are perhaps a little different? And those are the kinds of questions that I've been talking to Raphael about in the last few days, but I'll just leave them as open questions because we still don't have a clear picture. So let me begin with just a very brief introduction to quasi set theory. I'm sure one of you has seen this several times, but it's always good to refresh people's memories. Quasi set theory uses the fact that spacetime is a Lorentzian manifold. It's a Lorentzian structure, which means that it has a quasi structure associated with it. This is very special to Lorentzian geometries. If you euclidinize things, you lose quasi structure. You lose what is sort of very essential to the way we think about space-time. And if you look at a causal space-time, that is one without any closed time-like curves or closed causal curves, then you can extract from this space-time a partially ordered set where the order relation is simply the causal ordering on the events. This object itself is a coset. Okay, this causal structure is a coset. In other words, it's something in which an event doesn't precede itself, and it also obeys a condition of transitivity. And you can ask the question, well, how much information does this causal structure contain? And in fact, it contains a huge amount of information. It is very special to Lorentzian geometries. not present in divine geometry. So the question is, can you start to think of Lorentzian geometries in a way that's different from the way you think of divine geometries? So the causal structure was shown to contain a huge amount of information, which is basically the entire information contained in the conformal metric, conformal Lorentzian metric. And this is, of course, for certain, when the space-time satisfies certain causality conditions. And this was found by McCarthy, King, Hawking, and also by Malamud. These causality conditions are fairly weak. And basically what it's telling you is that this causal structure, in fact, contains a huge amount of geometric information. The only information left behind is the conformal factor. Okay? So if you put the causal structure together with the conformal factor, you get all of the geometry. So this partially ordered set has a lot of information. And this conformal structure is like giving you the volume element of every point. So causal structure plus volume gives you the geometry. And this is a classical result. It has nothing to do with quantum gravity. Now the causal set hypothesis takes this classical result fairly seriously. And it was set out by Bombelli, Myers, Lee and Sorkin towards in the late 80s. And that's sort of what I will call causal set theory, is a set of principles that were laid out in that paper. And the idea is that you want to replace continuous space-time with a discrete structure which contains this causal information, this information in the causal structure. But you put in a third condition, which is that of local finiteness. You require that the causal set be such that intervals in this partially ordered set, and by an interval I mean a space-time interval, so the future of this point intersecting the past at that point, these are space-time intervals, that you only want such space-time intervals to have finite number of elements. So there's a hypothesis of fundamental discreteness where volume is replaced by number. Okay, so cardinality, counting, replaces volume. Okay? So in other words, what you're trying to do in this process is to replace this particular result by a discrete version that says that the order relation plus cardinality or number should, in some sense, recover field geometry. Okay. So here at the bottom are a few causal sets, which do not look at all like space time. But the first thing you might want to do, so really what you want is to establish some sort of relation between number and volume. Was normalized to some by some cutoff. And so the first thing you might want to do is try a regular discretization. So just take the light cone lattice and discretize it. And there, if I look at an interval like this, the one is a time lag, this one or that one, then I can assign to that interval a number. And I can say that number is equal to volume upon V naught, the actual continuum volume divided by this fundamental cutoff. So that seems like a reasonable thing to do, but let's just look at what happens on the boost. Let's consider a volume like this one here. This, this one here. Yeah? And under a boost, what happens is that even though this one has a certain number of elements in it, under a boost, the same kind of volume has no elements. And so you see that the relation n equals b cannot be preserved under a boost. So regular lattices are not going to be sufficient to recover geometry because this regular kind of discretization doesn't respect the number to volume correspondence in any sense. So, yes?
Can you Sorry, I'm a bit confused about this statement, because you would think that this actual box is not, it's not physical at all. So under the boost, you'll still have those five elements.
So that's right. So if I actually looked at points that were in the quotient set, that's true. But really what I want to do is discretize a continuum. And I want to make a continuum discrete correspondence. So I want to say that that continuum volume that I had has so many points in it. And all I'm saying is that that cannot be done in a Lorentz invariant way.
I think he might have been asking why you had two pictures in the first one. Is this what you were asking? In the first one, there were like five elements of the quasi set in the box. And in the second one, the box was empty. So how did that come about? Is that the question?
Well, yeah, I would think that the box would still be the same.
I think she was looking at a different box.
Yes, that's true. So, I mean, I cheated because I should have looked at a box in which also got boosted.
Right.
All I wanted to point out was that that's a legitimate space-time volume. I mean, I could have even done it in the first picture. I could have chosen the same space-time volume, made really thin, and lying between two rows. So that also tells you that that's that space-time volume, because it's stretched out, doesn't contain any points. But one which is fatter will contain points. So there's no clear N is to B correspondence. That's, so it's true that I could have just done that. All right, so the way out of this, the way to get a correspondence is to then say that a discretization of space-time, a quasi set discretization, occurs via a random process. You extract a random lattice from the continuum. And here I haven't put in the order relations. They're sort of induced by the underlying space-time. Here it's just M2. And this random distribution satisfies a quasi distribution, in which case the number of elements put in a given volume is on an average given by the volume. So it's not exactly the volume, but if I sample enough intervals, and I will find that on an average, the number is given by the volume. So this is, in a sense, the best you can do. And this process, this sort of Poisson distribution, also has been shown to satisfy to be Lorentz invariant, which means there are no preferred directions. And this sort of random lattice comes with a whole host of its own problems, or if you like, characteristic features of what we think quantum gravity should be like. And that includes non-locality, but I will not talk about that here. So important in all of this is the notion of a faithful embedding, where you say, well, you have this a quasi set. How do we know that this discrete object has anything to do with the space-time? The way you make a correspondence is to say that, first of all, you have to have a map that takes you from this quasi set into the space-time. It has to preserve the order relation. And it also has to be such that that embedding itself is a Poisson distribution, is a Poisson sprinkling in the space-time. So this is a sense in which something approximates to a manifold or a continuum. And a good analogy to keep in mind always is sort of, you know, things that we deal with all the time, which look to us like a continuum, like a table, but, you know, fundamentally there are molecules which make up this big object. But on a large scale, you see something that looks like a continuum. So we have to imagine space time pretty much in that way. That's a physical. And here's an example of something that's not faithfully embedding into an interval in Minkowski space time. I should make very clear here that when I say that it's a Poisson sprinkling, I mean a high probability Poisson sprinkling. Because, of course, anything, something on the tail end of the distribution is not what I would call that. All right, so we know some things about kinematics, and I'm not really going to say very much except to say that there's been two very important developments very recently. One is that one can write a quantum field theory on a quasi set, despite the non-locality of the quasi set, or maybe because of it. and also that an action has been found very recently for the causal set. So there are various things that one knows about causal sets, but one of the big questions is how do we construct meaningful causal set dynamics? And that's what I will try to discuss today, is basically what are the various questions one has to ask. And right at the beginning, it's important to say that causal sets are really suited to a history's framework for quantizing gravity. So that's the framework which we will use today, which I use whenever I talk about causal sets. And the idea is to replace a collection of all continuum spacetimes with a collection of causal sets. Now, causal sets are not all manifold-like. In other words, there are large numbers of causal sets which look nothing like manifolds. In fact, a very old result due to Kleitman and Rothschild showed that most causal sets, if I just look at the space of causal sets, then most causal sets have this very non-space-like, space-time-like character, which is that they're just three moments of time and they're very fat and squashed. So in the large end limit, these things dominate. And so you'd think, well, if I just look at the space of causal sets, since most of them look very non-manifold-like, what hope do I have to do anything to recover manifolds from such a...
Can you say again, what is the characteristic of this causal set? What property do you try to express there?
So, each orange thing is a layer. So the bottommost set of elements is the first one. So these are just three layers. So in other words, these are minimal elements. There's nothing below these elements. Everything is above these. So I mean, all the layers, this layer is above this, and this layer is above both of them. It doesn't mean that all points are all related to each other, but there's a high degree of connectivity. And so, if you want to think of it in terms of time, this causal set pretty much stops there. I mean, if you keep on getting generated, meaning more points will be added to the maximal set of maximal elements, or whatever maximal elements are there, if you're trying to generate this. But this is basically, if you allow it to get completed, so if you go to the n equals infinity limit, then this is the structure that you should have. We have at the end of it, so there will just be three moments of time with this kind of distribution.
So, go ahead. Well, just so when you say such causal sets dominate when n gets large, do you mean ones that basically live and die for very short periods? I mean,
of this coordinate time, I suppose you could think of it like that.
When you say it's not manifold, like, what do you mean? I'm not.
I can't faithfully embed these into any finite dimensional manifold, finite dimensional space-time.
Faithfully, you mean? What do you mean exactly by faithfully?
Just what I said earlier, which is that I need the embedding to be such that it preserves the order relation, and also such that the embedded causal set, the embedding is a Poisson distribution.
So all right. So you're saying that for a given value of n, most sets are not manifold-like in the way you described, and as n gets big, they dominate the whole shooting match. So you want to get...
You want to get rid of that. That's right.
Okay.
So, I'm trying to understand this result intuitively, and I have a hard time, because I would think, suppose I were to randomly...
No one can understand it until...
Oh, it's not
fair. I'm all the mathematicians, I'm one of the biggest experts.
If I were to add like 16 points, at least one of them would be to the future of the...
You might think so.
Four.
I mean, anyone would think so.
But that's the thing, that causal sets don't grow in a very systematic way. I mean, in a way that you can actually enumerate them in a systematic way. It's just because of this non-locality, I think. It's just not... It's not like you're adding, you know, like a local set of links. You can add things which look very non-local in a certain sense. So that's perhaps the reason. But in any case, so these...
Can I ask a question about the Korasmin causal sets and manifolds? So suppose you have one causal set which is faithfully represents one manifold, then, you know, is it unique? That is, there may be many manifolds that faithfully represent this causal set?
So one of the conjectures in this theory, which we have sort of things that hint to this, that this conjecture may be correct, but one of the conjectures is that if a causal set embeds into two different manifolds, two different spacetimes, faithfully embeds, then those two spacetimes are in a sense close to each other. They're close in a sense, you can think of the following thing, because we have a finite cutoff.
Sorry, the distribution you choose, what is the distribution?
The distribution of Poisson distribution.
But with respect, where is the metric entering there?
There's only the volume element.
So can you just check? So the exponential rate is with respect to the Poisson distribution with
rate. So space time volume that enters.
So exponential of volume.
Yes, and the video. So for example, if you're asking what is the probability for a void, for there to be no points in a region, then that goes like e to the minus v upon v dot. So it's, you know, the larger the volume, the smaller the probability that it's going to be empty. So, you know, exponentially. So the conjecture is that if you have two manifolds that a causal set faithfully embeds into, then they can't differ by too much.
So, with respect to what measure?
Yeah. So these are questions that I think are still not fully understood, which is why I commend the conjecture. How exactly do we characterize? And people have done some work on this, people like, Luca Bumelli and also the Hamroldis have tried to examine how to put a metric on Lorentzian spaces and on this class of Lorentzian spaces. So you can do that for Riemannian spaces. There's this Gromov-Hausdorff distance, which you can put on Riemannian spaces, so they've extended it
so
to something
from,
called...
Is it different from De Witt distance?
From De Witt?
Yeah.
Yes, I think it's distinct from that.
So,
from the superspace metric?
Yeah.
I think so. I think it is distinct because you're looking at manifolds, you're looking at entirely different manifolds and asking how close they can be.
Mm-hmm.
You want to characterize, for example, possibility, I'm not going to get to the end of it. The possibility that, you know, in the continuum, here's the point of discreteness. That in the continuum, you can have space-time form. You can have arbitrarily small, arbitrarily complex things in the very small. And are we going to count each and every one of them, or are you going to put in, and this gives you a way to put a cutoff, and says that none of that is relevant. So I can, in my path integral, I can put in all of these things. And they could be much smaller, they could be structures much smaller than the Planck scale, and I'd still give them some respect. But within the causal set perspective, I'd say, no, they're not physical. They're just approximations. You can't take this to a degree where it's like trying to, you know, trying to describe solid, the physics of a solid to arbitrarily high accuracy without ever encountering molecular physics, atomic physics. It's sort of that same idea. You don't take the entire space of configuration as scale.
Yeah, but the question was about whether the represent. So you don't have any notion of how close two manifolds are, which could be inspired by that. So
we don't have a notion. We have some notions, some hints as to why that there is. So if you can say that dimension is one indicator that two things, if you can't, if something faithfully embeds into a manifold, then the dimension. Something you can calculate in the manifold, and so at least dimension-wise they're equivalent. Then you can also say something about the topology, spatial topology of these manifolds. So there is stuff, but I perhaps for another. I mean, there are indications that this correspondence is reasonable, but it's true that we don't have a scale. That's as far as I understand. But I think
the evidence is pretty strong that it's something like that theorem, that conjecture is true. But there's no precise mathematical formulation.
But But in the
or
in the
therefore proof. I mean, there's many formulations you could write down.
When you say the evidence is strong, then it suggests an idea of whatever measure of distance between two manifolds.
Right.
So that's somebody was saying people have
proposed
measures of distance between Lorentzian manifolds. Mm-hmm. It's much less trivial than in the Riemannian case.
But is it clear that this whatever measure you propose has some relationship with?
They have some relationship, but whether they're the right strength to be used in this theorem is not known.
I mean, there is a almost continuum version of the theorem, which doesn't quite.
That's true. The theorem is true in the limit.
In the limit, it is true. So when you take the limit where we are now getting rid of local finiteness, you allow things to be dense, then in that limit, it is in fact true that you have exact correspondence. So you're not quite at the manifold level, but you've made the partial orbit set very dense. You've made it non-locally finite. So that's what I'm saying.
What does become the Poisson distribution in the limit? So here you have an extra condition, which is this Poisson distribution. So, which is kind of a measure on how close the set is to a manifold. So there should be an analogous in the limit then of this Poisson distribution.
The limit is the limit of infinite density of the Poisson sort of process. So that V0 that appears in it.
Yeah, but if you're taking another distribution,
you
would eliminate the limit
would
be the same. So I'm saying, what differentiates?
Take V0 to 0, that's all that you're doing. And that's, I mean, the Poisson distribution is valid up for any finite V0. I mean, so I can do everything and then take the limit V0 going to 0 at the end of it. So I'm going to just quickly go through what.
March on.
Yes, we're going to march on. And I'm happy to do, we can talk about this when the. So the idea is, okay, so I'm going to just talk about this thing about dynamics, and the first, so we started off, Joe and I talking, said let's try something really simple with quasi sets. We can't construct quantum dynamics so easily, let's just try something very straightforward. And the idea was to try to do the analog of Euclidean quantum gravity on a disk, which we could do, to try to do that in the Lorentzian context, which meant trying to look at quantum gravity on a finite size interval. So we're looking at this class of interval spacetimes. And if I just wrote down very naively what the partition function for this is, using the Gauss-Bonnet theorem, I can get a whole chunk of the action as a constant in the Lorentzian version of the Gauss-Bonnet. And then I also put in the condition, which is actually very natural for quasi sets, and that is of fixing the space-time volume. It corresponds to fixing the number, the cardinality. And when you do this in a very naive way, you just get a partition function, which is a uniform partition function over all metrics, all 2D conformally flat metrics. So the idea is to discretize this object. If you discretize it, you say, well, that's a restriction, you've got only conformally flat metrics there. What is a discrete restriction here? When I discretize it, when I look at 2D, what corresponds to 2D conformally flat spacetimes in the quasi set context? And the answer to that is that it's some particular class of quasi sets which can be characterized, and they're called the 2D orders. And they basically arise in the following way. You can, if you just did a Poisson sprinkling into one of these spacetimes, and you projected onto the light cone coordinates and looked at the values of these light cone coordinates, these values, each of them, so just look at the u values or the v values, they're ordered sets. So I've just written it as an ordered set. V is v1, v3, v2. It's ordered because v1 is less than. As a number, it's just less than V2 is less than V3 is less than V2, and likewise for U. And I take these two orders and I intersect them. And I intersect, by that I mean V1 is below 2 and 3 in both orders. Is this clear? This is strange. Yeah. Okay. 1 is below 2 and 3 in both cases, but in this, 3 is below 2 and here 2 is below 3. So 2 and 3 are space-like related, but 1 is to the past of both 2 and 3. So I get a causal set like that. Now, not every causal set can be generated this way, and that's very important. So this is, in fact, a restriction. But all conformally flat spaces, when anything that embeds, any causal set that embeds faithfully into that, is a 2D order. Okay, so the space of 2D orders is a good discretization, just good restriction of the past integral to begin with. But not all 2D orders are faithfully embeddable into a manifold. So you can have things that are very bizarre. So you are including things that are non-manifold-like as well. And importantly, you're also not including things that are topologically non-trivial. In other words, somehow are embedding into some other kind of 2D topology. So they're all, in a sense, the good discretization of the trivial topology.
So if you have many non-manifold like things, doesn't it suggest that you should put a measure factor in your sum that
so
that it's not just the counting measure that you raise? It's related to the question I was asking. If you have a measure of the distance of how those things are close, then this
Right, but this is in the spirit of the sum path integral, or the sum of the histories, where I'm just taking something and I'm now, like I said, I'm borrowing heavily from the continuum. I'm taking the continuum action, I'm just saying, let me use that continuum action, which is just a uniform action, and try to calculate this object.
Yeah, but here you're assuming that the uniform action in metric space is a uniform action in causal set space.
Yes, I agree.
And the question previously says there's no... you know, what's the evidence for that?
Yeah.
Anyway,
there's
no evidence. So it might be...
That's a very legitimate question,
but... There's a highly non-trivial Jacobian there, you know, which suppresses non-manifold-like. And
yes, but the funny thing is you don't need the...
Okay,
so let me just tell you the result, because even though we do something so naive, and I agree with you, it's naive, what you find, however, is that this thing is actually dominated, this uniform distribution over 2D orders, in the n equals infinity limit, is dominated by the sprinkling, the Poisson sprinkling, onto Minkowski space. So what dominates this thing, even though you've included non-manifold-like objects, is actually Minkowski spacetime. And this is what the partition function, we're just doing something extremely nice and extremely, we didn't expect anything pretty to come out of this, but this is rather surprising. And it's all due to these results in combinatorics, due to Al-Sauer and so, in other words, a typical, here of course I've completely gotten rid of quantum, anything quantum, because everything is reduced down to typicality, and I've just got a classical measure really, and I don't have to ask complicated questions. But of course, really, at the end of the day, you want to do something more complicated, you want to be able to include proper relative phases, you want to be able to talk about full quantum theory. And just as an aside, just to sort of point out that recently there's been work on the causal set action, which makes it possible for us to do something a little less naive, to actually put in something that's more intrinsic to the causal set. And I won't go into this because I'm already running out of time, but there are things you can do even with 2D orders. So in order to... Now the question, of course, is that... I'm going to just change... step back a little and say, well, it's fine, all very well to try to construct partition functions and talk about dominance in a partition function. But at the end of the day, you want to be able to construct a quantum theory of gravity with things that are observable and covariant observables and so on and so forth. And what is a framework in which to even put forth these questions, a framework of quantum mechanics in which we don't have to refer to external observers and so on and so forth. And Rafael Sorkin has done a lot of work on this, so, and I'm sure you've heard of these things before, but I'm just going to go through some of the background to try to say, put forth a framework within which we're now going to start asking questions, which are more concrete questions. And this framework is something called the quantum measure formulation. And in some sense, the basic, I mean, the way I see it is that it's, the idea is to try to compare quantum theory, or structures in quantum theory, with stochastic theory. We're used to, when we first get introduced to quantum mechanics, keep comparing with deterministic dynamics. We're not used to comparing quantum mechanics with stochastic things. And this is sort of the starting point, try to now view quantum theory in the language of stochastic. Which doesn't mean that we're going to do classical stochastic theory, we're going to try to do something in type of quantum stochastic theory. And in stochastic theories, dynamics is described as a probability space, in a very specific mathematically rigorous sense. And what one is trying to do in the quantum case is to set up the quantum measure or the quantum dynamics in a very similar fashion. So we want to describe quantum dynamics as a quantum measure space. This is a measure that on events, and I will describe these terms as we go along. And we know something about this measure. We know that it doesn't satisfy literality. We know that probabilities, what we call probabilities in quantum theory, are not iterative. So we know that from the double slit experiment, we know that there's interference, things don't add up. If A is slit, if you have slit A and slit B, the probability to go through one plus the probability to go through the other is not, when you add them up, you don't get the probability of going through both of them. So we know that it's not additive, it's not a standard kind of measure, but what Raphael found in the early 90s was a new rule that this measure does obey, which is that three-slit experiment doesn't give you anything new. In a sense, if you think about it, it's basically telling you that the quantum theory that we have, we're so familiar with, and we love, is just, can be described in terms of amplitudes. It's not, you don't have to take the root of two-root of something to find. That's not the fundamental object, it's the square root of the probability, that's the fundamental object. Okay, so it's, or rather, I should say, the square of the amplitude, or the absolute square of the amplitude gives you probability, not the absolute cube of something. Not the cube of something. So this means that the quantum measure has certain properties that it satisfies, and the struggle has been to try to use these properties to get close to, or to try to get the kinds of results you get in standard stochastic theories. So what is a measure space, quantum measure space? You have to have this space of histories. You have to have something called an event algebra, which is a set of questions, if you like, that you would like to ask of the system. And this measure, which takes you from this event algebra into the non-negative. Okay? So this is the quantum, this is what we mean by quantum measure. Now, just to give you, just to remind you of what, how measure theories and probability measures come about when you're talking about classical stochastic theories, let's just review the random walk. And we can assign to every finite time path a certain probability. And that's just given by, so in this case it's a non-biased random walk. I just count the number of paths, and it's one of the number of paths that I have that gives me the probability for that finite path. So I can give you, so we're used to thinking of it as, oh, this is the probability for this particular path. But if I think in terms of the set of all infinite time paths, so if I let the random walker go on to infinity and look at all possible paths, that space of histories, omega, is a space of histories on which I define my probabilities measure. Okay? And I generate it the following way. I think of, I have this finite path, finite time path, and if I let it go do anything else for the future, then what it describes for me is a collection of paths in the full space of histories, right? So in other words, if omega is the set of all infinite time paths, then this little path that does this, and does anything else in the future, so the broom-like structure, this gives me a set of paths in here, which is characterized by this n, by this finite path. There are a set of infinite element paths. look exactly like this. So that gives me a set which I'll call sim of gamma. This is gamma. And this gives me a set in omega. These sets form a collection of sets in omega which on which I can define the same probability, the thing that I assigned, that said this is 1 over 8, I can give that probability to sim of gamma. Okay, so there's a probability measure on these sets. And if I take finite unions and intersections and complementations, I can generate an entire algebra or a field of sets. And that carries this measure. Okay? And that's how we normally do the random walk. That's how we think of in how we would formalize the random walk. So all finite time questions that you can ask will be given by that, by cylinder sets like that, the algebra that I generate from there. But I may be interested in infinite time questions, where I want to take countable unions of things. I may want to ask what is the probability for it to return to the origin. It's a one-dimensional walk. And for that, I'm going to have to take infinite unions of these cylinder sets, countable unions of them. And that element is not guaranteed to exist. I mean, it's not clear that I can put a probability on that element. But thank God for classical stochastic theories, almost always you can do this. And this means that you can extend finite time questions to infinite time questions. For the classic, for this probability measure, you can always do it. Because you can do it for infinite time questions, this means that what are these infinite time questions? It means that the infinite time questions are characterized by not the algebra, but it's so-called sigma algebra completion, which means that you're not, algebra was just finite unions of things, and you're taking countable unions of things, and countable intersections. And you're creating an algebra which is larger and larger in the process. And the sigma algebra is one that is the smallest one which is closed under countable set operations. Okay? And that contains infinite time questions. So this is just sort of a review of what I mean by the extension of a measure, which will come up in now because we're going to try to formalize the structure for the quantum theory. So A is an algebra, sigma of A is the smallest algebra that, sigma algebra that contains A. And the idea of an extension is that you have something on the algebra, the measure's on the algebra, you want it to uniquely extend to a measure on the sigma algebra. And that, whether that extension exists or not, depends on the nature of this measure. And that's the whole story. And by an extension, I mean that when you restrict that new measure that you have on the sigma algebra, you get back the old measure. So if you restrict it to the algebra, then you get back the measure. So this is what I want to say here. So more important to sort of think in terms of finite time questions and infinite time questions. I think that's a useful way to think about it. So what is the quantum measure space? I have this object which is, you know, not additive, but that's what I call the quantum measure. It satisfies that other sum rule. And as an example, one can just take a discrete time evolution, construct a quantum measure for just a well-known system, an n-dimensional, finite-dimensional system, n-state system, which is evolving in discrete time, evolving unitarily. And I construct a quantum measure on this, which is pretty much the kind of quantity that you'd expect. I've unfortunately used the wrong notation here, but So you can construct this full omega, which is the sample space, or the space of histories, as the set of infinite strings, pretty much like what you did in the random walk. You let it go on forever, and you get a set of infinite strings. So this is a set of infinite states, infinite combinations of states. So at time t for 0, it's in state 0. So if it was a two-state system, it goes like 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, 1, 1, 1, something like that. It's a string of possible states. at given times, and then you get a set of all such strings, and then you're trying to construct an algebra out of it. You do so very similar to the way in which you construct the algebra for the cylinder, for the random walk. And these cylinder sets generate the algebra, and you can construct a measure just from what are called these class operators. And again, in the quantum case, you can answer, because you have a measure now, you can answer finite time questions. But the question remains whether you can address, for this system, can you say that what is the probability for it to be in this particular state? So the same kind of thing, you say probability for return, you can ask what is the probability for it to return to this state? So what is the probability for a return? So you can ask a similar question here, and for such infinite time questions, you will again have to ask whether this quantum measure extends or not. Right? So in the other case, in the classical case, for probabilities, that extension is guaranteed, and is guaranteed for a probability measure. But for the quantum measure, we have to find out whether there are anything like extension theorems to this object.
Why does it matter if you can answer infinite time?
Right. So in a quantum system, in a non-relativistic quantum system, I think you'd be okay if you couldn't. Meaning, there's nothing fundamentally that you would... It would be nice if you have more questions you could answer, but maybe something about the system tells you that you can't. But when you come to quantum sets, and I hope I'll be able to do that, you need to go to infinite time, because when you're constructing something like this in finite time, sort of constructing this algebra, you only generate things that have labels on them. You generate coordinate sets which are labeled. And that label, which tells you, it's like putting a coordinate time on it, means that you can't ask, excuse me, you can't ask covariant questions. So in order to ask covariant questions, you have to kind of go all the way up. You have to be able to look at infinite time questions.
But you could take the approach that the universe has a finite lifetime and you don't need to do it. It's good enough to get close, so why can't you just set an upper bound on the amount of time and say, that's darn close to what I want? And I mean, it seems to me that one could sidestep this question if you wanted to.
Very hard. I mean, I personally don't know how to sort of think of that in terms of covariance, because...
Well, you don't have full covariance, but you've got approximate, right? Isn't that... There must be, as it gets large enough, you must get close enough to covariance that it would set an upper bound.
So I think, for example, if the kinds of dynamics that you had took this into account somehow, you tuned your dynamics perhaps, but in course of sets, I mean, with this growth dynamics, it's very hard. I think it's very hard, but I mean, maybe others have something more valuable to say. I just don't know.
We can talk about it privately, maybe. Sure. I'm not persuaded this is necessary.
Okay, so.
But if you want to do it, I guess. Sure.
Yes, the question right now is, I mean, there are two questions. One is whether something can extend, the other is whether infinite time questions are important. And I think that for this strict definition of covariance that we have, it is important to be able to ask infinite time questions, or to be able to characterize infinite time questions in a satisfactory way. Maybe not all infinite time questions, but at least enough for you to have constructed labels. So I don't know if I mentioned this before, but I think it's somewhere there on my slide. I should say that you think of observables in the measure theoretic context as simply measurable sets. That's one simple, straightforward way to do it. You might want to characterize them in a nicer way, but at least observables can be characterized as things as measurable sets. So, anyway, I don't necessarily want to have time, so I'm just going to try to skip. Except to say that there is a very nice formulation of the quantum measure now, which comes to work done by Faye and Stephen and Raphael, where they constructed a Hilbert space out of the space of histories. This Hilbert space can be shown to be very, to be isomorphic to the canonical Hilbert spaces, canonically isomorphic to the Hilbert spaces of standard quantum theory. So you've got a history's formulation and you've got a standard Hilbert space formulation. You can actually get the Hilbert spaces out of the histories. And this allows us to view the quantum measure, which was this, the, you know, odd non-iterative object, in more traditional or in more mathematically appealing language, and that is as a quantum vector measure. So rather than take values in the positive reals or the non-negative reals, you construct this object called the vector measure, which is related to the quantum measure, but it takes values in this history's Hilbert space. What this does is it allows you to think of the measure as an additive object. It's additive in this, as a vector in this Hilbert space. And importantly, there is an extension theorem that you have, which tells you when that vector, when vector measures can extend. So in other words, when can you take finite time questions and extend them to infinite time questions, or extend the measure to an infinite time question. Okay? So I just want to say that that question is at least now well formulated. And what one is going to try to do is try to look at a growth model for causal sets. And this is based on the kind of things that were done with the stochastic growth models for causal sets that David studied in his thesis with Rafael, and also worked on with Xavier Martin and Denjo. And this was to study, so this is from the more intrinsic point of view of causal set dynamics, where you just don't slap on an action from that arises from the continuum, but you ask for what a fundamental dynamics of the causal set could be. So the idea is to grow the causal set element by element, adding only points that are either to the future or unrelated to the elements but never to their past. So this gives you a tree of finite in the space of finite element causal sets, which is ever increasing. And here I've just given the label trees. And the model here that David studied quite extensively was of transitive percolation, where you just have one coupling constant, which is P, and you just require that P is Q equals 1. Now, this process generates labeled causal sets. So as I was saying, if you have such a thing, you always know that you have a time label. And if you want, you allow this process to go on to infinity, what you generate then, this omega that you generate, is the space of labeled causal sets. Labeling is giving coordinates. And the causal set version of general covariance is to talk about things in unlabeled ways. It should not matter how it's generated. So for example, if these three causal sets look distinct in the labeling, but they're actually one and the same if you remove the labeling. So that's sort of the sense in which you don't want the labels to be stuck on, you want the causal set to be an unlabeled causal set. But what you do in this process is you generate all the labeled causal sets. So in that case, you have to ask, well, I have a measure. How am I going to recover covariant questions? How am I going to ask covariant questions if I generate my causal sets like this? Because all I can get are labeled objects. So there is a quotienting procedure that you can do in the classical case, and it works very well. You can get rid. So if you go to all of the labeled causal sets, you say you look at a causal set which is labeled, an infinite element causal set, and you say the set of all its all other labelings, relabelings of this causal set are also in are all sort of made equivalent. So you do an equivalence by the labelings, relabelings, and you can identify, you can get a quotient space out of it, and that space is a labeling vector space. But this requires you to be able to take that measure that you had, extend it to the full sigma algebra, and then do the quotienting. If you couldn't do that, then it's not clear what you can do, how you can do an extension. And that's really the sort of question that we tried to ask. We looked at a model of complex population where the decoherence functional, which I haven't had time to explain, is just has this very simple product form. And In this case, because it's a simple model, it actually reduces to just a complex measure, a complex additive measure, and quite a lot is known about complex additive measures. These aren't yet measures, they're what are called pre-measures, because it's still only on an algebra, not on the full sigma algebra. But one of the conditions that it needs to satisfy is that of bounded variation. And this is just an example to show when bounded variation can fail, but one can show quite generically that for all values of P and Q, which are not real, so the real population, everything was fine. That was the stochastic models that David and Rafael studied. But if you complexify and you try to ask whether this measure can extend, it's perfectly well defined in the algebra, but if you want it to extend to the full sigma algebra, you find that it doesn't satisfy this condition of bounded variation. So it was a bit disappointing. We said, well, I mean, why is it that we can't construct observables in this theory? And then Rafael pointed out that perhaps this requirement of bounded variation is too strong. And really, the requirement of bounded variation, you can think of it as a requirement of unconditional convergence, which means that you should be able to sum up things in any which way you like. The sum up, you know, this countable additivity of a measure should be done in any which way you like. And with causal sets, as with the random walk, as with finite dimensional systems, there's something about the algebra that is really rather special, which is a question we've been exploring while here at PI. And I just want to end by saying that even though the measure can't be extended, there are some questions you can find answers to, some covariant questions. And for example, you can ask, what is the probability for the universe on the set of originally, or what's the measure on the set of originally causal sets, that is, causal sets which have a bottom element? Yes, they all have, so whatever happens on top, they all have a bottom element. And you can assign the probability, you can assign a measure to this, and that measure is well defined, this thing called an Euler function, seems to be well defined. And then you can go ahead and do more, ask more complicated questions. So there are certain questions that are living in the, certain covariant questions you can still answer, even though you've not been able to extend the full measure, the measure to the full sigma algebra. And so the question remains, can we systematically try to define what it means for an extension using conditional convergence? So that's sort of a technical point, but yeah, so I'll just end there.
Any questions? Well, I'd have a question. Is the idea that if you had that measure, mm-hmm. would lead you, and you compute a particular observer, it would lead you to some kind of path, I mean, some kind of integral over different causal sets, right?
It would lead you to a set of causal sets.
And you have to use now this measure.
So that
is the average of the observable on this set. I'm not saying this right, but it would lead you to a sum of causal sets, right?
It is. So it is in a sense already a sum. Yeah, it is a sum of causal sets. Where at the end of the day, what you're doing is rather than looking at a partition function kind of picture, you're looking at it in a measure theoretic picture. So you are summing of the causal sets, and you're doing countable sums of the causal sets. But the observables that you have are things which are measurable sets. So an observable is, does the universe have, is there a minimal element of the universe?
It's like saying, did it begin in a Big Bang?
Yeah.
Or something.
Yeah, I don't know. Why not? Yeah,
was it
begin in a Big Bang? No, but yeah. So depends on what part of a complex population space we're in.
So do I also understand correctly that the amplitudes with which you weight the causal sets will be complex in general?
Yes.
What would you do then about the sign problem? I mean, you couldn't do a simulation of this, right? So.
That we don't know yet. Well, so.
That's, I'm skipping too far ahead. But
this way of looking at it, so if you put in one of these. So this new action that has been produced, we start to use that and try to do Euclideanization of that action in some particular way. Then you could try to do, go around and calculate. But here, I'm not sure what.
Well, I suppose there's two ways of doing simulations in general. One of them is by an analytic continuation. So you might think to, which is what weak rotation is, for example. You might think to analytically continue these parameters, parameter P, to be real, and then you could do a simulation. In fact, it's very easy to simulate that particular dynamics, more so than most others, when P is real.
When somebody just
So these are these so-called transitive percolation models. They're defined by a set of transition in the real case probabilities, and in the quantum case, in the complex case amplitudes, which I sort of illustrated there. So you could say let's analytically continue. Let's solve it for real P and try analytically continue the result. That would be one. The other way, presumably, to wait for the people at I3C to build their quantum computer. that was one of the original motivations of quantum computing.
Oh, is it?
To sympathize. That's a way to solve.
I mean, I guess I'm wondering whether are you worried that these amplitudes are complex and how to.
I'm just worried that one of my friends is the same. For example, in spinform models, one also has complex amplitudes, and therefore there's simulation is possible, right? Now because you have a sine problem.
So here the thing is that so in principle, suppose you could compute all a set of all observables through some analytic process, but I doubt you could do it. Maybe for the simple models, there's certain classes of observables.
I think in principle you could analytically continue. The question is how difficult. You must have the same possibility in spin zones. I'm not sure. But here with this complex percolation, there is this very simple way to analytically continue because it's only defined by one parameter. In the case that Simity was referring to, which is the analog of the Einstein-Hilbert action for the causal set, there's a kind of, you can't do a weak rotation because there's no meaning to weak rotating the causal structure. At least no one has ever figured out any possible meaning to that. So it's unlike, for example, causal dynamic of regulations where there is a way of, because of the breaking of the law of the general covariances, so to speak. Here's a way of doing a weak rotation. Here there's, and for other reasons too, related to that, but here there's no way of doing that. That's something that you could recognize as a weak rotation. But interestingly enough, there's a way of doing something that's rather analogous to a weak rotation, which actually works better because in the gravity case that you're used to, when you do an actual weak rotation, you produce an action that's unbounded from below. This famous problem that killed off the non-causal dynamic regulation. Here you can do an analytic continuation where this action, the thing that plays the role of the action, is bounded from below. So it's not literally a weak rotation, but hopefully it's an improvement over the weak rotation. Then the question is, how hard is it to analytically continue back, having done the simulations? So I think we were just beginning to talk about some of those issues. Right?
Yeah.
So just new actions, very new.
So basically, there is some hope of, doing some Monte Carlo simulations or something like that for one of these, for this action, and seeing what comes out.
But from the perspective of this of these models, I think that just having a complex action is not so then you go into the question of how do you interpret these things. So suppose I can find you the quantum measure of one observable, then how do you wish to interpret this object? So then you go into whether there's an interpretation framework for the quantum measure, you there's a co-event interpretation. It's one way of trying to make sense of this. But I suppose the thing is that just off the cuff, if you just said, well, the measure of this is zero, then you'd say, okay, that's not going to happen. Right? So you can rule out, you can at least make statements that exclude certain kinds of behavior, preclude certain kinds of behavior. So those are things that you can define very clearly without even really having to have a full interpretation framework for them. But the idea is really to make analogy with the stochastic thing and to put this measure. And then, of course, this measure doesn't behave as you would. I mean, as in the classical case, you could have something that's a set of measure zero but contains things that are non-zero measure and so on and so forth, in which case you'd have to come up with an interpretation framework to deal with that.
Any other question? Okay, it's not that many. What is
it? So you said that the set of histories that are originary, that start with the Big Bang, is measurable in this complex correlation.
Yeah.
Are there any other sets?
So I found a whole lot of class who just used this.
By the way, you didn't say this code word, but I was just... If I do use the code word, then the problem that Sumati is really addressing is what's called the problem of time, right, in many contexts. How do you come up with meaningful questions that you can ask that on the one hand are covariant, on the other hand have a clear physical meaning?
The problem of time, of course,
it's probably
at the crux of the entire thing. So when you talk about finite time events and trying to extend them, that's because you don't want a label, you don't want a coordinate time label with you when you ask a very question. So this is a set of, so if I take anything which has a maximal element and I ask for that maximal element to be a post in the future, then you can calculate.
Post is like a big crunch.
It's like a big crunch. And then it becomes Big Bang. So I can calculate these probabilities for, or the measure for these things as well. Because it's all, you can now just sort of pretend that you've cut it off there and you've again got originally calculation.
Anything that has a unique maximal element, is it?
Yeah. Single, like a top element. That top element becomes a future bottom element. So that sort of thing you can easily calculate a whole range of these things. Using just this Euler function.
So why do you get a single top element?
So we're asking questions from the framework of, like, you know, what are the observable questions we can assign probabilities to, even though we can't do the extension. If we just sort of, and in a sense, this is what you do in the random walk. Most people do this in the random walk. They just sort of, they don't worry about whether there's an extension with full sigma algebra. They just try to see whether certain expressions converge or not. And that's the sense in which one is looking at an expression. And you're asking the following question. So the first case is there a bottom element to a positive set?
So
what is the probability or what is the measure on the set of causal sets with a single bottom element?
So can one ask the question of what is the probability of having a single bottom element?
Yes.
And does that answer come off to 1?
Not to 1. So I have to examine what the eta function looks like. I unfortunately don't have mathematical on my computer yet. But it's basically an answerable question. What you're asking is an answerable question. So you can actually answer this within this because of the eta function. And then you can answer the thing whether it went through one bounce or two bounces in pretty much the same way. You can ask what is the probability for that. But you, right now, at least I'm constrained by the fact that I need to know very specific details of what that causal set is. So I can't answer that yet in more generality. But yeah, these sorts of questions, so specific questions of specific classes of observables seem to be answerable, seem to be calculable. And so with Rakhal and Prakash last week, we were trying to see whether this question of extension can be done with, you know, just sort of looking for an arbitrary question, whether you can answer arbitrary questions by just carefully constructing that set in sigma algebra using the fact that there is this time labels. But that's a more general question, but yeah, it's, I guess, yeah, satisfying enough if one can get a finite set of questions that I'll ask you.
Okay, then that's close here. Thank you again.